accomplished lots of things. Her book, Touching Liberty, Abolition, Feminism, and the Politics of the Body, has been widely quoted and cited in meetings. And she's the editor recently of a book on language as object of Emily Dickinson in contemporary art, and another book on Emily Dickinson, the title of which embarrasses me, I'm forgetting. And is presently working on, and this talk is part of a project on a book that's forthcoming soon called Rearing a Nation. The title of her talk today is Writing Childhood, Literacy Lessons and Children's Diaries. And Karen is just back also from a Fulbright in Spain, where she was teaching at the University of Malaga on primarily 19th century American women, 20th century American literature generally, but particularly American 19th century feminist and abolitionist texts. So it's a huge pleasure to have her. And following Karen's talk, Lise Shapiro-Sanders, who is on the faculty of Hampshire, will be responding. Lise's own research is on English Victorian literature and history. She's working at the moment on a project on the Victorian shop girl and is currently teaching a course on Victorian childhood. So she'll be responding to Karen's talk and then open up the talk for general debate and conversation. So it's our pleasure. Thank you very much.
It is wonderful to be here. I am fighting some illness thing, so I'm going to try to keep having a loud voice, but if it fades away, people in the back should make little, they're fading away motions, or move closer. We'll see.
To the germs.
To the germs. Closer to the germs. I'll stay over here. We'll try to keep you safe. But the book project that this is part of, Rearing a Nation, really is trying to think about the work that childhood does in constructing and enforcing a large array of social norms, attitudes, behaviors, ideology. So trying to think about what it would mean for our understanding of history and culture if we were to look at children and take children seriously as not just measures of culture, but also actors in it. And so this is a part of that project about voice and writing. Considering children as historical actors entails coming to terms with their status as partial subjects, people for whom the traditional civil rights discourse of autonomy, enfranchisement, voice remains an awkward fit. Since, as even child rights advocates note, the rights of children should entail the right of dependency, the right to care, protection, guidance. Paying attention to childhood thus prompts us to examine what it might mean to claim voice, agency, or rights for a figure who is not, cannot, and indeed should not be fully autonomous. These are important insights, since independence may generally be overrated as a desiderata of civic society. Interdependence or partial independence may be far more accurate terms for understanding civic life for adults as well as children. For today's talk, I'm concerned particularly with questions of voice. I look at 19th century American children's initiation into reading and writing in order to ask to what extent and in what ways children have a voice in 19th century literary production. A little history. It was during the middle decades of the 19th century that the American book market came to be dominated by fiction. And it was during these same decades that the concept of childhood became associated with fantasy and fun. I will argue that such changes in attitudes towards fiction and towards children are not merely simultaneous, diverse, escapist responses to the same social stresses, but that they are profoundly implicated in each other. To begin with the obvious, the delights and dangers of novel reading depend upon literacy, and for most American children, learning to read stood, as it still stands, as one of the principal tasks of childhood. The standard accounts of the rising stature of the novel in the United States and of the history of American juvenile publishing, and this is quite different actually from the British scene, tend to present the relation between novels and children in oppositional rather than reciprocal terms. Since American children's books remain decidedly dour and didactic, long after the literary market for adults has embraced the novel as the most desirable and best-selling literary form. Children appear in American literary history less as embodiments of the imagination than as breaks on the heady run towards the fictional. Kathy Davidson's powerful account of America's beleaguered but enthusiastic turn to the novel does not give particular heed to writing for children or to the place of childhood in this cultural transformation. But many of the critical voices she cites do evoke children in their fight against the novel, and this is a quote from an 18th century reverend. Parents take care to feed their children with wholesome diet, and yet how unconcerned about the provisions for their minds. Throughout the 18th and 19th century, concern about the moral content of fiction and the dangerous excitement of the fictional form were generally expressed in terms of the risks that such writing poses to the vulnerable innocence of young readers. And this should be familiar to you from present debates about television viewing. This most recent report now on the violence of people who watch Charlie's Angels, I think. Sorry. Even Lydia Maria Child, who edited one of the nation's first and most successful juvenile literary magazines, and who included in her popular parenting manual, The Mother's Book, not just general advice on childhood reading, but 11 pages of age-graded and annotated reading lists composed almost entirely of stories and poems, still feared that, quote, it has a bad effect to encourage an early love for works of fiction. Since the pure mind of the child loves truth, the Association for the Improvement of Juvenile Books averred, fiction would inevitably prove corrupting, provoking evil tendencies. The child stands thus as a kind of model reader, the strongest exemplar of how reading might shape identity and character, precisely because children are viewed as least able to evaluate or resist fiction's allures. However, from the New England Primer, which the first editions in the US were probably 1863. The earliest one we have is 1727, but there seems evidence that it was around a good deal earlier than that. To Noah Webster's American Spelling Book in 1798, and onto the myriad of school primers produced during the 19th century, literacy trainers treated reading not as a temptation to vice, but as a form of virtue. It is easy to trace through school primers the malleability of ideas of virtue and the competing claims of faith, patriotism, and economic success. Yet the sense of literacy as a tool and sign of the good remained remarkably consistent. Ronald Zabore blames the nationalistic, moralistic emphasis of reading instruction, this is his phrase, and the generally punitive and boring regime of common schools with their birch rods, public humiliations, and obsessive drilling of dull facts for largely squelching students' relish for reading. Certainly any aesthetic or intellectual pleasures of reading appear in school books tightly shackled to ethical and patriotic lessons. But beyond this, for literacy primers, a child's relation to school and books stands in itself as the surest marker of virtue. Good boys will use their books with care, Webster's spelling book advises, and I just brought two 19th century primers. This boy is bad because he laughs and he talks and laughs in school, and he loves to be idle and doesn't learn his lessons. Do you think a good boy can love a bad one? Can his teacher love him? I think not. No one loves a bad boy. No one loves those who are bad. Or here's another one. This one sort of works the other way around. you get the words first. You can really see the literacy pedagogy here. John wants to teach his dog to read, so literacy lessons themselves become the sign of the good, not just to children, but to anything you can get your heads on. Laura holds the books, they're all happy at play, everything is good, and in fact playful, not just, but then a cross girl comes in and destroys everything. She is the child who doesn't have a book, is trouble. There'll be more, but because of my voice, I'm gonna keep turning it on and off so I can talk quieter. In The Schoolboy, or A Guide for Youth to Truth and Duty, John Abbott strives to convince his young readers that literacy offers a reliable measure of identity. A boy whose writing book is all blots and scrawls, he writes, not only looks dull and stupid himself, but is without inner worth, ashamed to look anyone, frankly, in the face. Such accounts present literacy training not just as a metaphor of moral improvement, but as an essential participant in the molding of each child's character. Thus, while the figure of the vulnerable and receptive young reader served literacy reviewers and social commentators as a useful tool for policing the fictional, the same sense of children's intimate bond to books promoted educators to present learning to read and write as acts of moral formation. The perceived links between children and books were called upon to contain and discipline what was thought wayward in both. A young reader is a pure, unsullied sheet, the introduction to the pictorial primer explains, ready to receive any impression that may be made upon it, and in this familiar Lockean conceit of the impressionable child, worries about the relation between child and book go so far as to cast the child as a book, as pages awaiting the press. Only well into the second half of the 19th century, long after fiction had claimed popular precedence and even artistic respectability, and the few remaining moral qualms had come to seem old-fashioned and hollow worries, did childhood begin to be associated with imagination and play, and children's books begin to encourage fantasy. The child is always something of a poet, John Greenleaf Whittier could write in 1873, as if this assessment of the child's creative faculty of imagination were self-evident, something everybody had always known about children, when obviously they hadn't known it 20 years before. The celebration of the imagination at stake in such comments reconceives children's imperfect or unfinished socialization as a mark of freedom and a source of power. In these terms, children no longer need books to teach them virtue. Instead, their very lack of conventional understanding makes them already poetry. John Bull, in an introduction to a privately printed volume of poems written by his young daughter, stresses Lucy's playfulness. And here's the frontispiece, putting them all in backwards. Very traditional image, girl holding book, looking away, being imaginative. This is Lucy. I'll leave her up here while you hear her poems. In the introduction, John, her father, stresses Lucy's playfulness rather than her piety, clearly afraid that anyone stumbling upon this book might think that his daughter was morbid or precocious. She said that the resurrection hymn was composed while swinging on a clothesline, he explains. And just think of that difference, that that someone would want not to say, look how holy my daughter is, she's writing this hymn about the resurrection. But no, I'm worried that people will think she is too holy, so let me tell you, she wrote this while she was playing. Lucy's poem, Poetry Everywhere, written when she was 9, similarly came to her, he reports, while sledding. Here's the poem. Poetry, poetry everywhere. You breathe it in the summer air. You see it in the green wild woods. It nestles in the first spring buds. You find it in the primrose rare. 'Tis in the apple blossom fair. It smiles in the maidens and youth. You taste it in the apple juice. 'Tis poetry, poetry everywhere. It nestles in the violets fair. It peeps out of the first spring grass. Things without poetry are very scarce. The conventional link between poetry and youth proves so strong for Lucy that she transforms the snow of her January inspiration into spring. Children's writing, no sign of the sledding in the poem. Children's writing is engaged in learning conventions of form and content. Lucy is extraordinarily prolific and polished in this work. She clearly strives to write serious, grown-up poems. Still, youth is responsible for what is best about this poem, the forced rhyme and real enthusiasm of apple juice. To value this line above the first spring buds and primrose rare locates the poetics in an imaginative freedom and unconventionality associated with childhood. even though it is clear that Lucy's own sense of the poetic would emphasize conformity to literary tradition. I presume that she thinks the primrose rare is better. Children's initiation into literacy exemplifies the split nature of both childhood and literature. The sense of children as inadequate, needing to be taught, disciplined, formed, alternates with idealizations of that formlessness as truth, freedom, art. D.W. Winnicott's psychological accounts of children's uses of transitional objects to produce a middle space of contingent freedom between the imaginary and the real depicts as well the cultural need the childhood itself fulfills. The creation of such a middle space is also, of course, what we ask of stories and poems. In children's own writing, the complex interrelations I have sketched between childhood literacy and the valuing of fiction permeate every page. But in this practice, the larger historical trajectory appears subsumed within the daily contradictions of these children's relations to their literacy, how it grants them voice and disciplines their expression. The diaries I'll draw upon here represent a very slim demographic slice of 19th century American childhood. All of these children come from affluent and highly literate homes in New York and New England. Their families valued literacy enough to encourage these exercises in writing and to preserve the product. Diary keeping was not a general part of literacy instruction in 19th century America. Most children practiced their writing largely through more mechanical, less personal tasks. And this is kind of a joke. This is not really such a normal model either, but this is from the 1830s, so in the time of some of my diaries, penmanship manual that suggests binding children's hands to their pens so that they hold them properly. So that's the other extreme. Not, I think, actually done very much, but still, they thought of it. The diaries I explore range from the late 1820s to the late 1860s, but to my surprise, the attitudes towards writing they reveal do not square easily with the historical pattern I have traced above, with the children of the 1820s stressing literacy's moral lessons, and those who write later in the century probing its imaginative possibilities. Instead, virtually every one of these children fluctuate in their writing between presenting literacy as a discipline and finding in the act of writing an invitation to imagine and play. If writing still largely figures in these journals as something to worry about, a measure for reckoning moral and pedagogical worth, it's not only that. The glee, anxiety, and drudgery of writing collide on these pages, attesting to the contradictions of social attitudes towards both literacy and childhood. As for the basic mechanics of writing, penmanship, children's diaries are far easier to read than most 19th century manuscripts. Engaged in the process of learning to write, lessons that traditionally consisted of repetitively tracing the letters of a standard school hand, young writers may be hesitant or uneven in forming their letters, but they are usually far more careful and the shapes of their letters more standard than individualized adult hands. The diaries reveal the children's clear pride in their signatures and authorship and a sense of the space for self-invention afforded by writing. Louisa Jane Trumbull, whose family called her Jenny, begins her first diary at age 7 by writing with high seriousness, "Born October 12, 1822, Louisa Jane Trumbull," on the top of the first page. On page 19, now 10, she tries writing her full name as if on a printed sign, all capitals with each letter painstakingly made out of dots, but gives up at the R of Trumbull. 13-year-old Sam Bigelow, still enough of a boy to fill his diary with snowball fights, ball games, traps for bobolinks, and spats with siblings, decorates the covers of the inexpensive paper-bound blank books he employs for his journal with an array of signatures. Samuel A. Bigelow, Master Samuel A. Bigelow, or the quite elaborately penned Honorable S. Augustus B. It is with a somewhat more serious sense of impersonating futures that 16-year-old Greeley Stevenson Curtis, still at school, practices writing his name, Mr. G.S. Curtis, Boston, New York, the bank, scattered in a far more elegant hand than his usual writing down an otherwise blank page. Writing serves these young people as a tool for conjuring more adult selves. Mary Ware Allen, at 8, revels in her own grown-up prowess and the noteworthiness of literacy as she records as the only event of a day that her little sister Lucy said all her letters. These children's relation to their journals and to writing itself is one of the most frequent topics of their daily entries. In these comments, they often sound like literacy primers, presenting their journals as opportunities to practice and improve their skills in penmanship and composition. Lucy Bull's somewhat satiric poem, Mabel's Good Behavior, allies penmanship with the patterned copying of other virtues. Very neat was her handwriting. She could write as well as Lou, never quarreling, never fighting. Mabel is the pattern for you. These diaries sport not only plenty of the blots and scrawls that John Abbott portrayed as moral blemishes in The Schoolboy, but also many passages in which children criticize, apologize for, and try to justify splattered ink and poor handwriting. While I was writing yesterday's journal, John tripped over the ink box and spilled the ink, Sam Bigelow explains below a splotch. That he feels the need to offer such an excuse reflects the fact that blots are punishable offenses at school. I had to stay into recess for my writing. I got a blot on my book, Sam complains a few weeks later. Still, Sam comes to recognize the practice in writing offered by his journal as less punitive and perfectionist than other forms. On the first page of his first journal, he writes with great care, I began my journal today. It is, above the line, rather cloudy today, crossed out this morning. His early pages full of corrections that strive for an improved style. But by the end of 1851, Sam's first year of journaling, his penmanship has become less careful, and he will go for pages making no corrections at all, certainly nothing of the stylistic nicety that would change a repetitive today for a fresh this morning. He recognizes his journal as a pedagogical tool, conjoined to schoolroom rigors, but it is also evidently a somewhat freer space where lapses do not bar him from recess, and where the constant requirements of self-correction are not quite so heavy. Grenville Norcross keeps a diary each year from his 7th birthday through his 16th. At some point, he copies over the smudged pencil journal he kept the year he was 8, correcting mistakes and adding explanatory footnotes. Occasionally, he notes how he has fixed his grammar, recording how the passage read originally at the bottom of the page. Preserving his youthful errors, even as he corrects them, Grenville reveals the layered nature of his relationship to literacy acquisition, allowing him to peer in this journal as both novice and master. In a kaleidoscope of literacy lessons, Jenny Trumbull copied a school composition on letter writing into her journal as a means of preserving it. That I may have it to read at some future time, noting with pride that this is the first composition which I ever wrote. Jenny's use of her journal to keep things that matter to her, that a school composition matters in this way, that in it she should write about writing, all reflect her sense of the importance of writing as a sort of receptacle and measure of self. In her composition, writing well is presented as a mark of propriety and gentility, a sign of class more than ethics. Before you write a sentence, examine it to see that there is nothing improper or vulgar in it. To write a letter with negligence, without proper stops, crooked lines, and great flourishes is inelegant. When a letter is written thus, the common apology is, you must excuse the writing, I have a very bad pen, or I'm in a great hurry. Later that year, amidst a splattering of ink, Jenny would take recourse to these very excuses. I never knew, this is the top one, I never knew such hard pens as these sticks, but I am in hopes that the rest of this page, in fact, the rest of this book, will look better and be written as well, if not better, than the best that is written in this book or this journal, which is, in fact, a book. The question of the status of her writing, if she writes in a blank book, does that make this journal a book, highlights Jenny's intent to create a lasting record of herself, and hence the desire for her writing to look better, does find in these appearances both a bookmaker's pride and a kind of moral force. A later entry, and this is the later entry, I just wanted you to see the handwriting difference. These are 2 months apart. It's not that she grew a lot older. She's being careful. A later entry produced in Jenny's very best handwriting elaborates her sense of journal writing as a mechanism of moral examination. Another week has passed away, and another evening devoted to writing in my journal has come round. It seems proper that I should view my conduct of the past week and to form some good resolutions for the proceeding. Have I improved any? Am I a better child? If so, I have not lived in vain. In the extreme meticulousness of this page, Jenny's care in writing well is the only answer she provides to the questions of self-improvement. Jenny undoubtedly intends larger ethical concerns than good penmanship when she reviews her week's conduct. Still, just as the practice of journal keeping invites these rituals of introspection, seeming the proper use of these pages, the ideological linking of literacy with virtue makes it all but impossible to assess oneself a better child on a blotted page. These children's commitment to literacy is thus hedged round with anxiety, with questions of moral and social worth. This double bind is particularly evident in their accounts of schooling, where children's assertions of the importance of their studies are frequently juxtaposed to largely discouraged accounts of their experiences with the process. Granville Norcross spends August at the beach, where his diary records that amongst his many holiday amusements, he played school. But once school actually begins in September, he has little to say about it beyond the fact that he went over and over again. Went to school. Nowhere does an idealized sense of school's value collide more painfully with its daily grind than in a little notebook kept by William Henry Potter during his school year at an academy in Colchester, Connecticut in 1836. The sun rose this morning upon the finest cross-out morning. The vernal season has yet dispersed and reminded me that today were to be thrown open the portals of our academic halls. Today were we to commence a new term. Today to meet old friends and see new faces. Today to draw our study chairs nearer the tables and our minds nearer our books. Porter labels the cover of his little book Pursuits, and the pages that follow the celebration of minds drawn nearer to books provides a detailed timetable of his school assignments and of the hours he dedicates or plans to dedicate to studying them. The gap between his opening passage, which seeks to cast his school experience within the elegant periods of the Latin rhetoric he would be learning in Colchester, contrasts painfully with the anxiety that pervades his lists of assignments. Rose at 6, paren, 2 hours too late, he begins one day's entry. If I get to studying by 5 or 4:45 in the morning, I'll proceed thus, starts another. William is serious about his schooling. His sense of its importance informs the care he takes in organizing his days. He evidently sees this diary as a tool for improving his academic performance. The diary itself is very much part of his education, even as it records the difficulty of mastery, how he feels always behind his and his teacher's expectations. 12-year-old Louis Pope Gratacap balances his aversion to school with a dutiful sense of its future worth. I got up this morning feeling very miserable because it was so near Monday when I would have to go to school, getting up at the outlandish time of 6 o'clock for 6.5 months through rain and snow and hail. It was perfectly abominable. But then I remembered that I was now laying the foundation to my future studies. I am now preparing my brain so that in after years I may be perhaps a learned man. Lewis's sense of schooling as the foundation to my future echoes endless advice books and primers. Like William's elaborate opening, the language for celebrating school recites school's lessons. All the emphatic personality of outlandish and abominable, the parodic heroic excess of rain, snow, and hail, replaced by pious cliches. Lewis remembered this phrase, as children might recall the New England primer's similar ventriloquy, "My book and heart shall never part." And in accepting this lesson, he records a kind of conversion, the past tense of his complaints giving way to the present affirmation of I am now. It's impossible to be sure of the tone of Lewis's capitulation. There may be an ironic edge to this sudden remembering of school's value. But in any case, go he must, and the next few days of entries display real pleasure in his learning, as well as accounts of school's dullness and injustice. The variety of values these children discern in writing and schooling is echoed as well in their records of their reading. Jenny Trumbull keeps track at the end of her journal of all the books she has read. Her list is interesting in itself, ranging from anthologies assembled for children like the juvenile Forget-Me-Not to the novels of Sir Walter Scott. But it also demonstrates the enclosed self-reflexiveness of these literary practices, how much children too see what they read and the fact that they read as a significant part of who they are. Sam Bigelow boasts of the pace of his reading. Dexter brought me a piece of a book, the name of which was Brislot Bill. After I came home, I sat down and read it through. I suspect that what Dexter lent him was the life and exploits of the noted criminal Bristol Bill, which would suggest that reading even bad books of bank robbery and counterfeiting nevertheless seems to Sam a mark of his goodness. He is, after all, avidly reading. 7-year-old Granville Norcross tells how Florrie began the castaways reading aloud to Willie and myself taking our turn reading, a model of family reading that Lydia Maria Child advocates in the Mother's Book as extremely beneficial, and one which makes Grenville feel proud to take his turn. On another visit from Florey, the children, quote, get out the village and play the Swiss Family Robinson, the pleasure they take in these toy houses structured by their shared reading. Mary Ellen never mentions a book she has read by herself. It's always, we began to read. These entries all represent reading as absorbed into family life and children's play, a site of personal pride, relationship, and pleasure. They suggest how much literacy has become a central feature of domesticity, informing both the content and the shape of household interactions, homes built out of books. Moreover, these diaries display the role of such literary recreations in forging community between children. Michel de Certeau notes that reading is never a purely passive act of consumption, that however much the reader is, quote, imprinted by and like the text, readers nevertheless find in the writings they consume associations of their own, what he calls spaces for games and trips. By challenging a passive model of consumption, he contends, we may be able to discover creative activity where it has been denied that any exists, and to relativize the exorbitant claim that a certain kind of production can set out to produce history by informing the whole of a country. There are few instances of claims more exorbitant than those of literacy primers, so certain of the receptivity of children and of the capacity of books to mold them aright. Yet these children's accounts of the uses to which they put their readings do indeed relativize such claims. As his friend Dexter passes to Sam the latest installment of Bristol Bill, as Flory reads and plays with Grenville and Willie, literacy becomes an important tool in the creation of a culture of childhood enmeshed in, but not identical to, the culture of the middle-class home. On the first page of her diary, Jenny Trumbull records the multiple influences that pushed her towards journal writing. As the other girls have got journals, I thought that I would have one too, as Mother desired me to write what happens every day. Mother and the other girls may value diaries for quite different reasons, but in beginning to keep one, Jenny accommodates them all. Jenny Trumbull honors her mother's desire, pledging, I'm going to write in this journal every day, age 10 years, 4 months, as if appending her age would make this promise more binding. Instead, she writes fitfully, sometimes filling 2 or more pages on a single day, at other times leaving the journal untouched for weeks. Once, in a large, messy hand, Jenny writes on the bottom of a page from the month before, March 29th, 1834, as I am filling up all the places, I suppose this mess must not be left empty, and this proves nearly enough to complete the page. To keep a diary involves a descent to genre, and as a form, the diary assumes and asserts the measure of the day. The desire of Jenny's mother that she write what happens every day values the daily in 2 ways. It presumes that the happenings of a day are a worthy subject, that each day matters in some way, and it considers that the development of daily habits, such as daily habits of writing, are good in themselves. For Jenny to leave a blank space in her diary seems almost like a failure to properly fill her days. Yet Jenny's unkept pledges to write every day and her clumsy efforts to fill each page suggest as well the artificial nature of these measures and habits. Her life as she experiences it does not fit well into such tidy constraints. If one result is irregular entries, another is that when she does choose to write, her entries are usually unusually lively and engaged. How are we doing? Bad.
We started 15 minutes late, so.
Yeah. Should I just keep going or should I skip some? I could skip some.
Sorry,
I think we're fine. We started quite late.
Okay. Thomas Hawkes notes the importance of the practices of mercantile accounting in the way that 19th century clerks used their diaries as moral ledgers of their time. Interestingly, among the diaries I've read, although Jenny may assert the value of daily habits of writing, such concern for reckoning each day does seem to be far more pressing for the boys. And I then have a few pages of boys being anxious about time and also trying to fill it nicely. And I'll just read you my very favorite, which is Grenville, who writes for a week, nothing important, nothing important, nothing of consequence, small doings, that's all he writes, but he can't bear that he would have a day that didn't say anything, even if it says nothing. And now, a little bit of William Potter, the anxious Colchester student, also keeping track of time. There are 24 hours in a day. I must see how my time is to be apportioned among the 3 principal studies, algebra, definition, and Greek grammar, Livy, and Latin grammar. If I sleep 7 hours, there will be 17 left, viz. 4 to algebra, 2 to Xenophon, 2 for living, 2 for my chores, 1 for Greek and Latin, 1 for grammars, 1 for writing, and 3/4 of an hour for meals, and 4 for recitations. As this adds up to 16 3/4 hours, William has left himself a scant 15 minutes for anything other than food, sleep, and work. I wish desperately to read recitations as recreations, but his handwriting is sadly too clear. Here the value of schooling and the value of time weigh upon each other. If diary keeping offers a means of apportioning time, it also becomes a record of the difficulty of that task. This is the last month of the year, Williams writes on December 1st. I must make as much as possible out of it. The literacy training that diaries provide these children is understood by them as a means of ordering their lives, of demonstrating in tidy pages, good grammar, and fully accounted days, an accomplishment at once academic and personal. Part of the pleasure, even in William's dreadfully anxious lists, derives from the imitation of adult behaviors and forms. Thus, by adopting these rules, learning literacy's lessons, these children also form these strictures into a source of power, self-validation, and even play. It's a paradox of some interest that nurture always involves compliance, the psychoanalyst Adam Phillips remarks, and the proud sense in these pages of education and literacy as nurturing the self clearly rests upon these children's efforts to conform. Phillips' work gestures towards a vision of education, evaluation of childhood that would not require this exchange. Yet he is at his most eloquent and precise in detailing the complicated clash of internal ideals between the child's, quote, wish for competence and the something to be mourned in its acquisition. These diaries acutely record that act of acquisition, allowing us to trace the process of enrollment in the rules of literacy and social expectation, to see the wish in these efforts as well as the pressure and loss. Their writing displays a capacity to meld conformity and play that need not only and always view them as opposites. One can, after all, enjoy moral seriousness. Thus the sketches in Harriet Appleton's blank book strive to claim such lofty concerns as her own. Beginning one entry with the description of a sunset, Harriet swiftly finds herself wandering into theology. Whenever I look upon the glorious scene, my heart is filled with painful thoughts that anyone can doubt that there is a God. Who can have made all this? Did it come by chance? But I have wandered from my subject. Surely, even at 10, Harriet knows that such thoughts are what one ought to feel in the presence of natural beauty. Far from a digression, her questions are virtually requirements of the form, as is the notion that these thoughts should be considered painful. In a sense, her blank book provides an opportunity to practice introspection, just as it offers a chance to practice penmanship or composition. Thus, it's not surprising that Harriet's musings, like Jenny's hope that she had not lived in vain, express themselves in conventional, nearly vacuous phrases. Such conventionality should not, however, be understood as a symptom of coercion or insincerity. Harriet and Jenny are learning the language of moral life in the forms and phrases that have been taught to them, and they recognize writing as an important part of that learning, a way of claiming inner worth. Even Sam Bigelow, the least introspective of these children, is morally vigilant in his corrections. I went out and took my, crossed out George's, sled and coasted down the hill, as if the use of the wrong possessive in one's journal were tantamount to stealing, coveting one's brother's sled. Just as reading features in these children's journals not only as marks of virtue and means of imprinting national ideals, but also as sites of play and cultural making, so too, even the most conventionally moral functions of the diary often dissolve into what Disserteau calls spaces for games and tricks. New Year's Day provides a traditional occasion for rituals of self-assessment. This morning when I woke, I thought I must write a journal, as it's the last day of the year, 1851, Sam Bigelow explains. But this sense of special compulsion does not change the content of his entry, which records only the usual of going to school and the very unusual of successfully reciting his Latin. Sam's awareness of expectations for New Year's self-examination and his sense of the appropriateness of journal writing to that task still does not prompt him to produce the requisite assessments. He ends his previous journal with a poem that even more exuberantly flouts the serious expectations that come with closure. The end of the book extending from September 14th to November 1st, so be it. The summer has passed and gone, and winter has come with its snows and storms. Now for the skating, and now for the coasting, now for the sleigh rides. So goodbye, nothing. Composed and written by Flourish, S-A-B, so be it. The customary obedience to the divine will, so be it. The literary conventions that mourn the passing of seasons erupt under Sam's hand into a festival of sledding. So too, though Lewis Gradacap begins his journal with the year, his relation to the genre of New Year's assessments and resolutions proves as playful as it is earnest. New Year's Day. I awoke earlier this morning than I generally do and was on the point of getting up when I noticed that the light which I took to be the day was only the light of the moon, and also that there was a large and fat barrier before me in the shape of my brother Tom. And I knew if I attempted to get out while he was there, I would certainly get some blowings. Accordingly, I got into bed once more and my thoughts turned to the year that had passed, 1862. I thought how I had been saved through this dreadful year, and how my dear mother and father and brother had been also. How had I passed the last year? I had passed it disgracefully. I had given way to temptations. At this moment, heard a large noise in the road and a cry of fire. I jumped up, and so did the barrier, who, on looking out, found that a pack of loafers had given a false alarm. I got in again and once more thought of the past year. Lewis Gradacap's diary is a marvel of disjunctions. The self-assessment and introspection expected of a New Year's entry pivot effortlessly into the pleasures of jokes and narration, the excitement of the cry of fire in the street. Between one sentence and the next, the fat barrier can be recast as the brother thankfully saved throughout this dreadful year, only to become the barrier again a few lines later. The language of morality and theology are not understood or experienced here as at odds with Mayhem and Play. Instead, the tension between the radically different kinds of functions that diary writing might serve becomes in itself a kind of game, one of the things that Lewis plays with as he writes. The play of children's diaries extends beyond the literary, the pages themselves offering a space for jokes and pranks. Thus, this diary not only records the gleeful animosity of the brothers, but becomes another site for their blowings, as Lewis revels in his ability to use his diary to call his brother names. Inside the front cover of Greeley Curtis's diary, an elaborate and highly conventional warning has been penned. Reader, you're a sneaky puppy, you is, for looking into other folks' business, so just stop. Clearly, there is as much pleasure here in the imagined trespass as there is in the assistance on privacy. Far from a serious tool of introspection, these diaries thus also figure as sites and occasions for teasing and disobedience. George Bigelow not only reads, but writes in his brother's diary. How are you, Bob, you little bugger? How are you, GB? And below this infraction, Sam adds a message clearly intended for his brother's eyes. To the city marshal Turkey, catch that puppy that wrote that if you can, and so goodbye from SAB. The pages of Sam's diary become a game of cops and robbers. So too, while Lewis uses his diary as a place to secretly bait his brother, he also records how he stole and read the diary of a neighborhood girl. Roz took her diary out, she carries it in her pocket, and shows it to us, all and me. When we had got it, we ran upstairs into his room, locked the door, and read it all through, though after all, there was not much in it. Roz's diary becomes a medium of flirtation and transgression, its content of less interest than its capture. These may be extreme instances of the capacity of diary writing to be an occasion for romps and roughhousing, but even in their most straightforward reporting of each day's occurrences, it is the account of these children's play that almost invariably receives the most detailed and engaged descriptions. Sam will often say little about school, but every day in winter he remarks on whether or not the snow conditions were good enough to allow him to coast there in the morning. Rebecca Hogan finds a feminist poetics in the refusal of women's diaries to privilege amazing over ordinary events in terms of scope, space, or selection. Such disregard for conventional standards of importance is undoubtedly characteristic of the diary genre as a whole, but it is a characteristic that gains particular significance and utility for those members of society whose own sense of what matters diverges furthest from the hegemonic line. In their renditions of coastings, Grenville also makes battles with his paper soldiers. These diaries trace the contours of a childhood culture that has its own urgencies and desires. Thus, even as the literacy training proffered by diary keeping seeks to inscribe these children in a network of temporal, moral, and literary habits, the children themselves remain capable of using these pages in quite other ways as well. It is precisely in these departures from adult norms that what Stephen Cagle calls the diary's own distinctive identity, its created personality, becomes most evident. I suspect that even in the 19th century, these diaries were preserved, at least in part, out of appreciation for these childish oddities. That it is the very ways in which these diaries thwart adult expectations that they most fully, richly fulfill adult desires. The effort to use literacy to discipline and instruct children thus also and simultaneously serves to record childhood specialness and difference. Carolyn Steedman warns against seeing children's mistakes in spelling or grammar as meaningful parts of these texts. Adults' delight in charming childish error is irrelevant to an understanding of children's writing, she contends. Certainly, adult pleasure in such errors and children's incomplete mastery of literacy's demands belittle these efforts. Yet Grenville's decision to preserve as footnotes the grammatical mistakes he nevertheless corrected in copying over his diary suggests that children themselves might share in this split view of their writing. Wishing at once to conform to adult norms and to find pleasure in the ways that they don't fully comply. Mary Allen reveals a similar ambivalence in the many passages in her journal in which she writes about her younger siblings, both celebrating and separating herself from their childish vantage. Elizabeth was looking out the window today at the cow, and she said, "Mama, if all the cows were ladies, they would come in to dinner." In recording her little sister's words, Mary uses her diary to preserve a childhood perspective that already at 8 strikes her as funny, charming, naive. Her sister's attempt to understand social conventions highlights Mary's own comparative mastery, but it also invites her to imagine a different world order, with cows around the dinner table. Elizabeth's effort at logic permits Mary a moment of fantasy. Gillian Brown writes movingly of the vulnerability of children's play, how often it is dismissed and punished by adult imperatives, how imperfect and insecure is the separate world it offers. These children's diaries suggest that children's play is not only vulnerable and permeable to adult interventions disrupted by them, but that it is in some ways made out of and around these disciplines and conventions. That is, the dualistic construction of child play and adult responsibility misconstrues their relation, missing how children may take for themselves and enjoy the very things adults intend as lessons. I began with the contradictory way children are used to ward off the novel, and yet are seen as embodiments of fictional fantasy and play. I find that children's own writing carries similar contradictions, but in a manner that suggests that we may want to look at these tensions differently. Imitation, the trying on of adult voices and concerns, the virtue of good penmanship and daily habits, conflates conformity and play. Thus, in the pages of these diaries, docility to literacy's lessons become the condition of a certain independence, pleasure, even power. Heeding how children attain their own literary voice reveals the elements of compliance entailed in all our efforts to speak for ourselves. Thank you.
Begin by thanking Karen Sanchez-Etler for this fascinating account of children's writing and the function and importance of literacy in 19th century America and the lessons in literacy that she's told us about today. I hope in this response to highlight some particularly intriguing issues raised here, to suggest a few further questions, and then to open up for what I have no doubt will be a productive and engaging discussion. This research illuminates a number of concerns about the significance of reading, writing, and the book itself to the construction and experience of childhood in the 19th century. Sanchez-Epler's larger project considers children's status as, quote, partial subjects, quote, people for whom the traditional civil rights discourse of autonomy, enfranchisement, voice remains an awkward fit, unquote. Yet what this work on children's diaries suggests, first and foremost, is that considering children's subjectivity can enable us to develop new, more complex, and more productive accounts of experience that diverge from the discourses of individualism and autonomy with which we are often familiar in this context. Indeed, the children whose diaries Sanchez-Epler reads in this analysis demonstrate a complicated and self-conscious relationship to their own subjectivity and selfhood, particularly in their sensitivity to the ways in which the practice of diary writing both reflects and shapes their status as subjects constituted through the influences of family, education, religious belief, and the activities from chores to schoolwork to play, which fill their daily lives. Sanchez Epler begins by citing 19th century discourses on fiction and its dangers in the United States, noting the dominance of rhetorics of consumption in the references to the, quote, wholesome diet on which children should be fed, temptation in the evil tendencies to which children might succumb through the wrong sorts of reading, and habit in writings on children's reading in this period. These rhetorical logics were common in other national contexts as well. Across the Atlantic in England, for example, Florence Lowe's 1906 article on the reading of the modern girl noted that magazines were likely to, quote, destroy all taste for serious and continuous reading, unquote, lamenting the fact that, quote, good literature is being pushed on one side by the enormous mass of written stuff that is yearly issued by the press of an inferior and second-rate quality, upon which our girls feed greedily, with the very natural result that they cannot digest food of a superior nature. In an attempt to counteract the pleasures and dangers of reading, Lowe advocated strict parental supervision and informal censorship. Quote, parents should sternly forbid the reading of more than one magazine a month, for the indiscriminate reading of magazines is perhaps more harmful than anything else. It creates a distaste for reading anything but snippets and the lightest of literature, and gives the reader an air of superficial knowledge that is far worse than downright ignorance. The spaces in the mind may be filled, it is difficult to clear away rubbish. Yet good literature had its value. As Sanchez Epler notes, children's reading in 19th century America was conceived as a pedagogical tool to produce virtuous readers and to shape both morality and character. At the same time, children's reading seemed to signify the creative powers and possibilities of the imagination. Nowhere does this appear more the case than in the diaries which form the subject of Sanchez Epler's current research. These texts reveal to the modern eye, as indeed they did for 19th century readers, it seems, their writer's struggles to perform the value of their education through proper penmanship, spelling, and grammar, yet they also suggest the presence and potential of writing to signal the importance of play. To me, the most evocative example of the playfulness with which child diarists approach their journals is the warning, which you've just heard in Greeley Curtis's diary, which might disregard the diary status, or readers who might disregard the diary status as a private document. And then the quote, reader, you're a sneaky puppy, you is, for looking into other folks' business, so just stop. The framing here of the diary is other folks' business, and the tension between the reader's recognition of having been caught in the act, the desire to continue in order to finish the sentence, and the injunction to stop at the end of it, suggests the self-consciousness with which such writing projects were undertaken, and moreover illustrates the ways in which children might adapt the genre of the diary to their own purposes. This example raises several questions with which I'll close in order to leave time for what I'm sure will be a fruitful discussion. First, what exactly is the status of children's diaries as texts? Whose business are they, after all? And what do they tell us about our own desire to more closely know the experience of childhood in the 19th century? And I ask this question because in my own research on shop girls, the diary was the object that I always wanted to find and never could really find because working class young women's journals were so rarely kept that to me this was a treasure trove illuminating a certain feature of American life during this period that I have had some difficulty locating in a different context in England. Secondly, because they were written by children from a privileged socioeconomic background, these diaries also raise questions about the archiving of primary historical and literary documents. Which texts are valued, saved for posterity, and that seems so particularly interesting in the case of the diary, and why? How and where did these writings by children signal the ambivalent nature of the diary as both private and public documents? What do they have to teach us about the self-conscious construction of subjectivity and identity by, as well as for, children in the 19th century? And finally, what lessons in literacy do we take away from the study of such writings? How do they correspond to contemporary debates over the practice, function, and significance of children's literacy in the present? These are just a few of the many questions that are raised by Karen Sanchez Epler's work, and no doubt there are many more that you have, which I look forward to hearing in general. Thanks, and again, thank you, Karen, so much. So I'll open. and allow you to ask questions you may have.
I want to answer your last question with one last these files, which I didn't show you.
The cuttings.
This is a little scrap of child writing from 1848 in the Port of Falls Huntington papers, and what's important about it is that it's not a diary. It is literally a little scrap of paper. You can slightly see the edges of it, mm-hmm. The transparency, but it really is just slightly heavy or a piece of paper, not even square, got frayed edges. And it has one of these moral expressions in pencil on it. How on earth a piece of paper like that has survived from 1848, that is, that no one through all of those years decided to throw this promise to have a simple and serious life. By this young girl, we don't know exactly how old Lily was when she wrote it, because it's not dated, it's not in any, it's just a scrap. So I think there is, even with these middle class children, a kind of tenuousness, and the process of finding these things marks that too. I have not been successful at finding things by working class children, though I have been trying. I mean, I found working class children's writings in other forms, but not diaries. So there's clearly a class piece, but there's also an age piece. That is, there are no archives of writing by children. There are no libraries that organize their holdings so as to make visible that anything is writing by children. You can only figure out that something is by children if you pull out family papers and then take those trees that have everybody's birth and death dates on them, and you put them on one side, and then you go through what everything is and keep quickly trying to subtract until you figure out, oh, this must have been written when someone was, 13 and down, whatever one's wanting. So that even for the most affluent children, there's a way in which this is still a really buried kind of material. It's been remarkably. And often libraries don't know that they have them. The New York Public Library told me they didn't have any, and I found four great diaries by New York kids, but that's not yet. It reminds me a little bit of what it must have been like doing work on women's writing and on race in the 60s and 70s, when those weren't search categories.
Where you can connect up an adult with a child?
Well, Jenny's mother is also a diarist. So the American Antiquarian Society, which has Jenny Trumbull's diaries, also has her mother's diaries. So that's quite wonderful. And that's actually how so there's actually a lot one can know about her from mother's accounts. So what she's like as a child from the outside, not just from the inside.
Mm-hmm. I guess the only thing like that I have read is diaries from Ralph Barton Perry early in the 20th century. No doubt kept because he turned out to be an important person in the diary as materials in Houghton Library at Harvard, because in effect, that's a little bit like child drawings of a person who became a famous artist, let's say. And in fact, you can see in Ralph Barton Perry's diary at age 6 or 7, a rather thoughtful kid who has puzzles and that you can connect with the adult. But I just wonder if there. Cases like this, or whether they're just in.
I purposefully went for family collections them and tried in that way not to look for the juvenilia of people who grew up to be writers. Though that would in itself also be a really interesting thing and an interesting comparison, but I was really trying to get sort of mid-range, middle-class literacy and not have people say, well, you know, of course this is a really interesting diary. This person grew up to be a novelist, but to just, and Lucy Bull never publishes poems as an adult. That was her poem moment.
To know what they don't put in diaries, obviously. What you shared with us seems rather ordinary, although, I mean, in terms of events in life, not ordinary, I suppose, in the fact that they're embracing, in many cases, a commitment to a morality of the culture. Is it true that, I mean, as you look through these diaries, do you find that events of life are really rather underplayed, deaths of loved ones, major events in their lives. I found it strange, quite honestly, that there weren't those kinds of examples.
Yeah, I have a chapter in this book that's about children's deaths, and so partly the places where my children diaries talk about other children's deaths I put there. There are certainly moments when there's something momentous like that happens. Again, Jenny Trumbull, who's one of my favorite diarists, is my favorite example. And her younger brother dies in 1833, and she writes about that amazingly and at great detail and length. And then after the sort of 2-week period around his death, and he I think he figures only once or twice in very brief and unengaged mention prior to his becoming sick. Then he has these 2 weeks in which the diary is all about him. And then he isn't mentioned again till the following February, where she has a cold sore, and she compares, that sore and its discomfort with the raw chest that Johnny had had from his fever and all the mustard plasters that had been put on it, and I guess half a year earlier at that point. And then she never mentions him again either. So it's sort of interesting that there's like this one intense moment, and then he doesn't stay with her in her diary writing as a kind of presence, which doesn't mean that he didn't in her life and mind in other ways. They are ordinary, but go ahead.
Well, it gives you a sense of what they see the diary as being for. That they don't turn to it for every event of their lives, but rather maybe these most powerful ones and then in some sense the most banal.
Right.
And there's not much in the middle. And not much self-reflection I gather from that about feelings of growing up. So they don't see it as a vehicle where they can explore self. Beyond,
because you don't see these moral commonplaces as an exploration of self, right?
Well, I'm trapped in my own time, and I think you're addressing my question in a very appropriate way, because I am trapped in my own time. But if it is playful, one could imagine breaking the bonds of this is the way I'm supposed to think of self, and these are the things I'm supposed to consider, and they would intrude a bit more, but they don't seem to. So that there's a playfulness, but it has boundaries to it.
Yeah, I think it does. I think in the 19th century, the idea of being a good child has more allure than it does now, that we tend to think that the mischievous or the troubled child might be a more attractive model of what childhood is like now. And I think there really is a serious effort on these kids' parts to be good children and therefore to represent themselves as good children in these books, which may also mean somewhat representing themselves as boring children.
Well, I don't call them boring as much
right.
as that they appear to be so aware of. They're very caught up
in everyday things. They're much more into telling you events than they are into telling you feelings.
One more question, and I'm sorry, well, not so sorry, but there we go. I'm getting morally free of these ill people. And now I have forgotten my question. No, the question of privacy. If you situate the question of privacy now in terms of time, I suspect then that this book is being so private is not the same as when I was a child. It was, you had locks on books, and it was seen as your privilege actually to keep it private. So that it, you wonder about their sense of audience and who would see it as having effect.
Yeah, they are expected to share these diaries in certain ways. Often grown-ups give them to them, so they're like, you know, grown-up instigation to be keeping them. Some of the kids, you think that there must be grown-up regulation to make sure that they're writing in them. Sam Bigelow, for instance, writes a half a page every day. It doesn't matter if he has an interesting day, a boring day, he has to fill a half page. And it's hard not to think that somebody's saying to him, he has to fill a half page. And even these really exciting pages, he never turns them over and writes like another 2 lines on the other side. Forget it. Fits the page, that's it. And others, Lewis describes going and reading his diary to a neighbor adult who gives him an apple as a reward for, I guess, having written a good diary. So there are all sorts of, there's some grown-up who sometimes writes comments on the margins in Harriet's book. So there seem to be different sort of monitorial things that go on inside of these two. But they also clearly, like Roz or with the piece that you quoted, George and Sam obviously are into each other's diaries. There's another pair of sisters who, whose diaries I don't have, but I have their letters to their brother who is fighting in the Civil War. And in their letters, they describe, the third sister describes the other two having diaries that look just the same on the outside, and they sit down and they write them at the same time, and she knows that they write the same thing. Like, there's a sense that their lives are like. Feel at all like they were being written for me with that kind of futurity. But even though I agree with the sense that what they record is quite banal and often very repetitive, and they whatever it is that they're into, they will write about the same things over and over again too. You get a sense of them. I don't know whether you did in this format so much, but they're really different writers from each other. They're really different kids from each other, and you get a sense of them and their lives. That does feel like a privilege to me. not like, oh, this country, I'm gonna teach your kids. You know, even the ones you worry about, like even if you want to say, well, yeah, come on, it's okay, it's we do sometimes, you know? But, so in that way, I felt really present with them, and I've been thinking, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how do we not just represent children, but in some ways make space for their voices. And so I've been trying to think, as I've been doing this work, like, you know, would there be any audience for an anthology of short segments of 19th century children's diaries? And I can't tell. I mean, there's a way in which they're, in which I think they are really these self-contained things. They don't tell, I mean, very dramatic stories. Nothing very much happens in them. So it's, you know, it's hard. And I think even, you know, in comparison to the women's journals that have, I think, become something that have a certain place inside of curricula and things like that, they tell a different, more self-conscious, richer, in some ways, or at least one that's easier for us to recognize what's important about them. You know, Granville will really go on for pages describing these battles that he makes with his paper soldiers, and who goes up what hill, and who goes up the other hill, and which, you know, they're paper soldiers. It is during the Civil War, so it's kind of, you know, it feels extraordinary that he's doing this in such detail, and then not only playing it, but recording it. And he actually makes an index to his diary. And in the index to his diary, he does keep track of important things we might think of as important, an aunt getting married, or George Washington's birthday celebrations, or, you know, things like that. But he also keeps track of the day that a particular paper soldier got killed, or, you know, things that are from the world of those battles make it into his index as important things. But, you know.
What about gender themes? This last is an example, but I do some work on children's art. And boys are more likely to portray action, particularly action that is relatively bloody, messy from time to time, than are girls. Is that a big part of your story, that in the mid 1800s we would expect to see gender differences? What kinds of gender differences did you see?
Well, certainly there's more description of what we would call active play among the boys, which I would include those paper battles, but you know, or the sledding, which are things you've heard, but also a lot about fights at recess or in the field behind the house, or hunting things, things like that. Girls are much more likely to write about their siblings, except for fights. Boys will, and I guess you've got a few instances of boys writing about their siblings in fight situations or teasing situations, but in terms of sort of description, telling you what they're doing, things about their lives, girls are much more likely to do that than boys. Boys seem much more anxious about the temporal functions of diaries than girls. That is, that I need to write every day thing. There are a number of girls who say that, but they don't do it. The many more boys who have a kind of bookkeeping attitude towards what it is that they're doing here. And I didn't find any girls who made indexes, for instance. I found three boys who made indexes or little abstracts on the margin of their diary. So there's a whole sort of learning bookkeeping thing that seems to be going on for these middle class boys who would presumably have businesses, one of the sort of futures that they're imagining for themselves. But actually kind of interesting, in these middle class families, there's a kind of equivalence on the values placed on schooling between girls and boys. More Latin and Greek learning
among the boys than among the girls, but 8-year-old girls studying geography, and, you know, clearly a lot of, and mathematics, a lot of sense of that daughter's education is being taken seriously in these households as well. Yeah.
Karen, are you able to find out sort of what they grow up to become, and what are these young men that seem to have this sort of obsessive compulsive disorder that leads to academics? It sounds exactly like my eldest godson, and then we all have to know, you know.
He actually did, the guy with the toy soldiers did grow up to be a botanist. There's a classified piece to him that he held on to.
It does sound like the Gerald Durrell or whatever.
Right. But some of them you know, some of them you don't know. You know, it just, family papers are such weird things. So, you know, it's really uneven. Depends in part on what libraries you find them in, how good they are in tracing that stuff out, and also just whether they were able to